Hey everybody, this is Kevin McGuire for the Crystal Ball Run podcast, the official podcast of crystalballrun.com. I'm going to be flying a little solo today. We do have an interview with Matt Zemek from College Football News. We'll get to in just a minute. Before I get there, though, I want to remind everybody to make sure you're subscribed to the Crystal Ball Run newsletter. You can find out all the details right on crystalballrun.com. But we're going to be giving away a 30 for 30 Collector's Edition Blu-ray to one random subscriber. So make sure you're subscribed and you'll get a chance to automatically be entered to win that prize. We're going to give it to one random subscriber. If you're already subscribed, you're already hooked into the contest. So hopefully you'll have something coming your way in a little bit later this month. Of course, you can also follow Crystal Ball Run on Twitter at Crystal Ball Run and like it on Facebook at facebook.com/Crystal Ball Run. That's enough of the self-plugging for the site now. Let's get right to the interview. Matt Zemek, College Football News, coming up. And joining me now on the Crystal Ball Run podcast is Matt Zemek, a columnist for College Football News. Matt, it's great to talk to you. How are you doing today?
All right, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've had you on my bucket list for a podcast guest ever since I got into the podcasting game. So I'm sorry it's taken so long, but it's good to hear from you now.
A lot of voices to be heard from, so not a matter at all.
Yeah, there are plenty of people out there covering college football. I really grabbed onto the way you cover the sport. It always seems like you've got opinions on just about everything that's going on. And it doesn't really matter if you're watching any game on Saturday. You know, I have a good idea that you're going to have a take on what's going on. I know the Thursday night games, the Friday night games, Saturday all day, pretty much. You're watching college football just as often as it's on, right?
Indeed, and you know, that's what any member of the selection committee should be focused on, watching the game. And it's the main problem in many ways that the sport has had over the past several decades of AP and UPI, now USA Today coaches polls, is that the stakeholders, the people who, you know, help shape the rankings that decide bowl matchups and national champions and BCS games, the people can't often watch the game. They're either beat writers who's, you know, have 6 or 7 hours blocked out on a Saturday to cover their own team. They can't watch the full 14 hours on Saturday. And then, of course, the coaches can't pretty much watch anything on Saturday. If their teams play on Thursday, yeah, then they might be able to get to a TV and watch some games on Saturday, but they can't. So watching games is what it's about. The play really is the thing.
Well, I'm glad you brought all that up because that's what we're going to get into first. But before we go any further, let's just get you on the record. I don't know if you've made this point yet or not in the past. Are you pro BCS or are you pro college football playoff?
I am definitely not pro BCS, and I am pro playoff with the caveat that the sport should emphasize beefing up the regular season first. I am pro bracket buster. I believe that college football, and this is something Mark Cuban has said, should be able to move toward a bracket buster model where we set aside 2 November Saturdays and we flex them and we create a model where in mid-October, you know, pretty much after this weekend, the results would enable the sport to arrange TV-friendly matchups between and among teams from the various power conferences, and we slot them in November. One team plays 2 games, one home, one away, crisscrossing the various top teams in the country. And this should pertain to the top tier of competition, but it would also pertain to the middle and lower tiers of the FBS so that we get robust and equivalent non-conference matchups. And that's really where the sport needs to reform. Obviously, I don't see it happening, but that really is what the sport needs to do more than anything else.
I like the idea in principle, and I would honestly love to see it. And I think you and I actually see eye to eye on a lot of these kind of issues. Do you think that there is ever going to be a day when we do see something like that take place, whether or not the NCAA is involved or not? Because we've seen a lot of discussion over the last few months really about a split between the NCAA and these power conferences maybe packing their bags and starting their own league. Do you think that that might be something that could come into play if that scenario were to ever unfold?
You know, what really grabs me here is that, you know, Senator John McCain has been pushing hard for a la carte cable. So in other words, you get only as many channels as you want. So it would destroy the current bundling model that exists. And my friend Alan Kenny, also who is affiliated with Crystal Ball Run,
of course,
has written about this, and he has noted how if a la carte cable becomes a reality, it would destroy the current pricing structure, and it would dramatically reshape all of the television contracts that exist. So it would demand a substantial reworking and a recalculation of all the dollar values that are flowing out there. So that actually might be the real catalyst. It might force sport to create national network television matchups, and it might blow up this current regionalized or conference-specific model that we have now. So that might, interestingly enough, be the engine for change, but it really seems a long ways off if it's even going to happen.
Yeah, and I always generally call myself a purist of the game, and I wish things, a lot of things, could go back to the way that they used to be. But we see certainly that television plays a vital role in the evolution of college football and college athletics overall, probably no more than in football. So I think if there is ever going to be a tipping point, it's absolutely going to develop probably from what the television networks are doing with the cable providers, the satellite providers, all that stuff like you mentioned. And I'll make sure to include a link to something that Alan wrote before about that so we can dig that in and throw it in there. But Matt, let me ask you, a lot of talk about the selection committee going on right now. Sounds like we will find out the official list of names sometime next week. But of course, by now, a lot of the names have been reported to be confirmed. I don't know if anybody has gone on record, certainly, of saying they're on it, but it seems like we have a sense of who's going to be on this selection committee. And I don't think there's one person who has sparked a lot, as much debate as much as Condoleezza Rice and her inclusion in the potential lineup for the selection committee. A lot of negative feedback, I think, negative reaction from a lot of people. I think just mostly probably being caught off guard because she has never really had ties to college football the way that some of these names have. I know you wrote a little bit about this on College Football News. I wanted to get your take on the idea that Condoleezza Rice could be on the selection committee. Is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? Are people too quick to judge this one?
I think it's a terrible thing, and I'm going to tell you why. And okay. This is what I wrote about this morning in my new weekly affirmation column at College Football News. This is a celebrity choice. I mean, Condi Rice, I'm sure, does in fact know a lot about the X's and O's and the tactics of football, but the central qualification, as I pointed out earlier, you have to devote your life to covering the sport. And what that means is you're watching the 14 hours of games on Saturday, every Saturday throughout the course of the season. And I think it's highly doubtful that Ms. Rice, as smart and as intellectually prodigious as she is, has watched 14 hours on Saturday, every Saturday, for a full season any time in the past quarter century. She's had bigger things to do.
Right.
So for any person who can't watch 14 hours on Saturday, every Saturday during the season, and Archie Manning and Mike Trangise fall into the same category. I mean, I doubt that they're watching 14 hours and that they're staying up for the Pac-12 late night game the way you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not able to make that commitment, you should not be on the committee, because a selection committee in any sport, basketball, college basketball, represents this. You should be watching games and you should know the full landscape of the sport. Because we're not just evaluating four playoff teams. We're evaluating whom the top four, six, eight teams in the country are playing each week. So you have to watch games, and you have to watch them, most of them, live. I mean, obviously, some you can watch on tape delay, direct or film study.
Right.
You should generally be watching, the top 30, 40, 50 teams in the country live as they come to you every Saturday. So Rice's inclusion on the committee is simply not a serious choice. If the committee wanted to go with a woman, which is great, it's something I heartily endorse and support, there are professional women who have studio host roles or other roles that enable them to follow college football on a regular basis. And if the committee was also serious about bringing in a quote-unquote outsider perspective, it should be someone like Bill Connolly or Matt Hinton or someone else from the plenty of legitimate avenues to travel here, but Rice, Manning, and Trangese represent unserious inclusions.
So you're obviously not of the people, the part of the people out there who believe that because she's a woman, she certainly doesn't deserve to be on. That's certainly not the case. And I thought that I think a lot of that is ridiculous. And that, you know, I think I kind of wrote about that a little bit on Crystal Ball Run. But let me ask you this: do you feel, you know, man or woman aside, do you feel that you have to have played the game the way that some people seem to believe?
No, I mean, yeah. Bill Connolly and Matt Hinton are, you know, as qualified as anybody in the country to make these kinds of decisions. I mean, We see that, you know, let's go outside football briefly. Doris Burt, I mean, did she play, you know, NBA basketball? No, but she, through study, observation, and work, she has made herself one of the finer basketball analysts in the country, including for the NBA. I mean, through study and hard work, you can know a craft really well. We've seen examples of people who, you know, just through study, look at John Hollinger, also in basketball, as a guy who, through statistical analysis, has put himself into an NBA front office. I mean, he didn't have any sort of prodigious playing career, but he understands the game. And look at, you know, the statistical analyst that Butler coach Brad Stevens, you know, has brought aboard. You know, just a kid, but he knows the numbers. Think of also of Moneyball and Billy Beane's assistant. You know, this pudgy Yale nerd, you know, who rose to a place of prominence and was eventually at a point where he was telling, you know, players and also scouts, you know, what and how to think. So if you attain mastery of a given craft through study and hard work, you know, the notion that you have or haven't played the game, it really doesn't hold much water these days.
If you were in charge of putting together the committee, how big of a committee would you go for, and what kind of people would you be looking to bring in? Would you be looking for a fair representation among the conferences, or does that really not apply for you?
Well, you know, there's a large block of people who quite understandably think that any person with a specific conference affiliation should not be part of the committee. Mm-hmm. And so to satisfy that block, that faction, I would populate the committee with analysts, with, you know, Bill Connolly, Matt Hinton. I'd put Chris Fowler on the committee because his intellectual independence, I think, is widely respected in the sport. Could find about, you know, nine people who, you know, just really care about college football and whose integrity is unassailable.
How about you? If anyone came to you and asked if you wanted to be on it, would you say yes?
I think there are people more qualified than I am, you know, because I cover games from home. You know, I don't travel to press boxes, and I'm not in the arena at that same level. So, frankly, no, other people are more qualified than I am.
Do you think having a selection committee is a good idea at all for this process that's moving forward, or is there some other method that would probably be, you know, better served for the 4-team playoff model?
I have over the past 2-3 years, I championed the idea of a selection committee. I mean, I thought it was a really good idea. Kirk Herbstreit mentioned it, I think, as that far back as 2006, 2007. I could be wrong, but Kirk got out in front on that matter. So I have always liked the notion a selection committee, but I always thought that it needed to be the analysts, the analytical types. So if a selection committee is to work, it has to have that kind of composition. But now, in terms of, you know, getting to this point of, you know, what's the best solution, what's the best way to tackle this, the best way to have a 4-team playoff with a minimum degree of controversy is to play better, bigger non-conference games. I mean, this season, we would need Alabama to play Stanford. We would need Northern Illinois to play Georgia. We would need Fresno State to play Baylor. We would need South Carolina to play Oklahoma. If we play those kinds of non-conference games, decisions are made for the sport. The decisions get made themselves. The games football. And by, you know, I say a generic we, I mean, obviously we as fans, I think, recognize that. But, you know, do the conference commissioners and the other people who wield power, are they willing to break from the current economic model of paycheck games and body bag games and all these cupcakes that fill our Septembers? Are they willing to break from that model to embrace, you know, bigger television revenues, but also bigger risk-reward calculations, you know, that there's more to be won, perhaps, but there's also more to lose. And it seems as though the power brokers in the sport don't want schools to miss out. They want the current model to be preserved because it's easier to get that 11-1 record and easier to get that BCS inclusion, you know, when you're playing easier non-conference opponents.
Yeah, and part of that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where if there is ever going to be a change, it's probably going to come from the TV executives who have a little bit more say, because if they can convince these conferences that they will actually be more, you know, they'll be benefiting more by playing those kind of games, you know, maybe that's going to be what it is. But, you know, the future of this sport is actually kind of uncharted waters, I think, from a lot of areas. So we'll see what happens. Obviously, again, the selection committee should be made official sometime next week. I don't really know when. I don't know if that date was confirmed or not, but we're all looking forward to seeing that and seeing how that all comes together for the upcoming season. But, you know, Matt, we're still in the middle, really, of this current season, which is seeing a number of things unfold. We're seeing Texas continue to struggle, and who knows what's going to happen with Mack Brown's job. We've already seen Lane Kiffin fired and left at the airport at USC. Obviously, a couple changes probably underway and some key head coaching positions going on. And, you know, we're continuing to debate whether or not the SEC is still the clear number one conference and whether or not there's a conference out there that can compete. One of the conferences that I think has really come on strong, at least at the start of the season, has been the Pac-12. It seems like that conference, more than any other conference outside the SEC, has been really gaining some national attention, maybe national exposure, and it's starting to get hyped a little bit more because some of the teams in that conference have been coming out to play. Look at what UCLA has done this season. They've had a pretty strong start and highlighted by a win against Nebraska, which, you know, that was a remarkable second half after a tragic week, of course. And of course, we've got Oregon and Stanford doing their thing. Washington has looked really good this season, even though they're coming off a loss against Stanford. When you look at the Pac-12, is that the second best conference, and can they take a shot at the SEC?
Well, I think the Pac-12 has definitely established itself alongside the SEC as one of the top two conferences. And it's interesting that Dan Wolkin tweeted Saturday night during the Washington Stanford game that it was the kind of game, he tweeted, that reminded him of an SEC game years ago. I mean, that was a rugged, physical, very virile, manly kind of football game. I mean, Stanford's style is of that nature, and Washington was able to trade punches on a very even level with the Cardinal. I mean, you saw plenty of quite dynamic playmaking, Ty Montgomery of Stanford and Washington's receiving core, and yet that athleticism on the perimeter was matched with some very rugged slugging in the trenches. I mean, that was a high-level game. It was better than Ohio State Northwestern, and I'd say it was even better than the LSU-Georgia game because there was more of a mixture of offense and defense. It was a more blended and balanced kind of game, and so Washington didn't get a win, but the Huskies won a lot of respect from anyone who stayed up to watch that game. And because Washington's now a player in the Pac-12, I think you have four high-quality teams in that league: Oregon, Stanford, Washington, and UCLA. That's a top four that would match up quite favorably with the top four of any other league in the country, including the SEC. The SEC probably rates as better than the Pac-12 only because the SEC has a lot more quality depth. When you get to the Pac-12 South and Colorado and Arizona, that's where the league gets a little thin. And the SEC, especially with the emergence of Missouri, mm-hmm. and also with Tennessee showing some backbone against Georgia, the SEC is probably deeper at this point than the Pac-12. You do go 1 through 12, or in the SEC's case, 1 through 14.
But where is the defense in the SEC? It seems like it has disappeared in some of their bigger games so far this season.
Yeah, and that's why I think when you compare the top four in each league, that the Pac-12 would have a lot of success. It's just going to be in that middle area where the Pac-12's offenses for the Colorados and the Utahs and the Cals would probably not be able to keep pace. You had mentioned, and I'm sorry for not answering this question directly, you know, can the Pac-12 take a shot at the SEC? Well, the two conferences are not scheduled to play each other in the regular season, and the two conferences do not have a single bowl tie-in together. And it's one of the great shortcomings of college football over the past 10 years that the Pac-10, now Pac-12's best teams, and the SEC's best teams have not been able to play in the postseason. We in college football have missed out so much because USC was not able to play LSU in 2003, Auburn in 2004, Florida in 2006, Georgia in 2007. The list goes on and on and on. There's only been one SEC Pac-12 BCS Bowl matchup in the BCS Bowl era. Maybe we'll get an Alabama-Oregon or Alabama-Stanford title game this year, but it is one of the great flaws in college football that certain conferences get segregated from each other in both the regular season and the postseason, and no two conferences reflect that problem more than the Pac-12 and the SEC.
Hypothetical situation for you. Let's say Alabama runs the table, you're SEC champion. They're obviously going to be in the BCS championship game if that holds true. Let's say Oregon runs the table. They're number two right now. Obviously, they've got everything in front of them to make a run back to a BCS championship game, maybe take on another SEC team like they did against Auburn a few years back against Cam Newton. But what happens if Ohio State finishes undefeated? Is there an argument to be made that Ohio State would deserve to be in a BCS championship game over maybe Oregon, Stanford, whoever comes out of the Pac-12, if that's the case?
If Oregon or Stanford winds up unbeaten, there's no way Ohio State jumps Oregon or Stanford. The fascinating debate would be if you have an unbeaten Ohio State going up against a one-loss Oregon or Stanford, and it's one-loss Oregon or Stanford, you know, looks really imposing at the end of the season, you know, beats UCLA by, let's say, 30 points in the Pac-12 championship game. Ohio State, meanwhile, slides by Northwestern in an ugly Big Ten championship game. That would be a fascinating debate, but I think it's fairly clear. I'm not going to say 100% clear, but I think it's fairly clear at this point that if the Florida State Clemson winner and or the Oregon Stanford winner on November 7th finishes unbeaten, that team from the ACC or the Pac-12 will finish higher than an unbeaten Ohio State.
And when you think about what you just said, think years back, could you have ever imagined a situation where we'd be talking about an undefeated Ohio State getting left out of the big party like that? I mean, that's got to be almost unheard of.
Absolutely unfathomable. You're so right.
Now, my question there is that more a reflection on what Ohio State is or isn't, or is that really just a product of the Big Ten supposedly being so down right now?
You know, I think the Big Ten's deterioration is part of it. I really don't think it's an Ohio State issue because, you know, when you're winning games as regularly as Urban Meyer does, that's not a problem. It's not something that should ever be looked at as a problem. It's more of a reflection of the Big Ten's deterioration as a whole, the fact that in Michigan and in Nebraska don't carry the heft on a resume that they used to. And it's also credit to all the good work that Florida State, Clemson, Oregon, and Stanford have done to build themselves up to a really high level. So the last thing we should be doing here is criticizing Ohio State or saying that the Buckeyes are somehow the problem here, that they've somehow diminished themselves. That's hardly true. It's really just a credit. It's a credit to everyone else in other conferences, and it's also a reflection of how Ohio State's opponents are going to minimize the quality of the Buckeyes' resume, and that's something that Ohio State, of course, can't control.
Now, we'll really get interesting when we start to talk about an undefeated Louisville passing Ohio State. I don't think we'll get to that point, but the whole scenario in my head is just blows my mind sometimes when I just think about it, considering what Ohio State has been over the years in this BCS era. Let me ask you something, Alex. We talked about Oregon a little bit. We know what they can do on offense, but a team that's just lighting up the scoreboard at will is Baylor. If you had to choose between Oregon and Baylor, you know, which one would you rather face, if that is a fair question at all?
Oh, it's a fair question, and I'd immediately choose to face Baylor, because Baylor has not played anybody with a pulse yet, and Baylor has not yet played a road game, and that's why I'm very interested to see what happens at Kansas State.
Right.
Even though the Wildcats are struggling, just the fact that Baylor has not yet ventured out of Waco, it leaves some questions surrounding the team. I think that if you put Baylor and Oregon on a neutral field right now, I would be very, very confident in taking Oregon. Because Oregon's been through this rodeo before. Baylor hasn't, and Baylor has a lot to prove in its Big 12 road game this season.
I think Baylor's going to be a lot of fun to watch, but I am curious to see how they handle going on the road now against a Kansas State team that can play defensive football. I know, like you said, this is not the same Kansas State team we saw last year, so it'll be interesting, though, to see Baylor go on the road.
Kevin, let me quickly duck in that it would be a pretty delicious bit of revenge for Kansas State to beat Baylor here after Baylor ruined Kansas State's march to the national championship game last season.
Absolutely. Cannot overlook the revenge factor in any kind of game, especially that one. So that would be a nice little storyline to follow on Saturday. You know, another game in the Big 12 that's certainly going to be grabbing a lot of attention early on in the day, of course, is the Red River Rivalry, Red River Shootout, whatever you want to call it these days. Technically it's called the Red River Rivalry, but whatever. Texas and Oklahoma. Obviously, Oklahoma has dominated this series the last couple of years. Certainly, we know what happened the last 2 years. Texas is in a real interesting situation right now. They need this win really bad, because if they lose, it's going to be a mess the rest of the season, if you ask me.
Oh, no question. Texas not only needs to win, but if Texas can't at least play Oklahoma close,
right?
When this becomes another 30-point blowout, you have to think that Mac Brown is definitely gone to the irretrievably gone. That there's no way he can undo or change his fate. What strikes me about this game is that Blake Bell played so well against Notre Dame. Oklahoma's offense looked crisp. It was clear and lucid. The plan by Josh Heupel and Jay Norvell, the offensive coordinators, it came into fruition beautifully. And then Bell regressed against TCU. And so if Bell can't get back in the saddle and can't regain the rhythm that he displayed against Notre Dame, Texas just gets a wacky special teams play or some other weird development to go in its favor. As much as I do think that Oklahoma is going to win this game, two words, Chase McCoy, I can envision a scenario in which Texas wins this game. So there's a little more intrigue than I had originally expected, and it's just because Blake Bell has yet to show week-to-week consistency.
I think that's a very fair point as far as Oklahoma is concerned. I don't think that this is an Oklahoma team that can blow Texas away the way that we have the last couple of years. But I am curious to see how each team approaches this game. Because certainly, if something happens to go wrong early on for Texas, my biggest question is, how do they respond? Certainly, that's been one of their big problems the last couple of years. It kind of snowballs out of control for them. So that, to me, would be one of the big things to keep an eye on for the Longhorns. And, of course, like you said, they need to at least be competitive against Oklahoma. If they don't win it, it's going to be bad. But if they get blown away, it could be catastrophic in many senses. So we'll see what happens this year at the Red River Rivalry. It's a great tradition. It's one of the few great traditions that seems to have survived through realignment. What do you think about that?
Yeah, thank goodness for Texas, Oklahoma, and Florida, Georgia. Two unique neutral site, split crowd rivalries. The color and the passion that you see there. You do not find that in professional football. And I really wish that more of these kinds of events could persist in the sport.
What's your quick take when you heard the news that Tennessee and Virginia Tech are going to play in Bristol Motor Speedway? I don't know if you're a NASCAR fan or anything like that. I know I'm not, but you know, to me, it seems kind of interesting. I know it's equidistant, and it's been something that's been in the works for a number of years now. Do you think that that's going to be an interesting scene there? Do you think that we'll get 160,000, I should say?
I think the crowd will be there. I mean, I think this kind of depends on, you know, will Tennessee move forward as a program, but all signs point to that, in fact, happening, given the way that Butch Jones is recruiting. So, yeah, I think that as long as Tennessee is on an upward trajectory or as long as there's hope in the Vols program, that, you know, there'll be enough Tennessee fans to pack that stadium. I frankly think that this is kind of gimmicky to kind of cram an event into a place that is not, you know, designed for football, that doesn't have, you know, various kinds of football facilities. But, you know, the local economic impact for Bristol and just the enthusiasm that it'll generate, you know, that's a good angle on it. So I don't really have a strong opinion, but I do think it's kind of a gimmick that there's no reason why this couldn't be at Neyland Stadium.
Yeah, there's no doubt it's going to be a gimmick, Ben. To me, I sort of like the idea of some neutral site games, but overall, when you look at it, you know, Neyland Stadium is pretty nice, and it's got a lot of tradition, and it's a great scene, as we saw against Georgia last weekend. So, you know, I'm kind of torn on it, I guess. I like the idea. I'd like to see how it ends up, but ultimately, I like keeping the college game right on the college football field, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. I mean, Neyland Stadium is a treasured place to watch a college football game. So, you know, why you'd want to pull an event out of a stadium that great, you know, that just doesn't resonate with me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. So, you know what, Matt, I'm going to let you go. But before I do, you know, we're about midway through the season now. So if you had a Heisman vote, who would be your top vote getter right now?
Okay, well, I'm going to mention right away that I really don't get into Heismans or national title playoff rankings until the beginning of November.
Okay.
But if I had to vote today, I would probably go with Jameis Winston of Florida State. That his numbers and the small number of mistakes he has made. I mean, he has played as close to perfect as any player in the country, and so for that reason, he would probably be the leader at this point. But of course, we'll get to see him play Clemson, and then we'll all be able to reevaluate it.
Exactly. So you know what? I'm going to check back with you in November, and I'll ask you the same question and see if your opinion has changed at all by then. All right?
Sounds good.
All right, Matt. Before I let you go, just remind people how they can get in touch with you, anything else you have going on, and if there's anything in particular you're watching this weekend, feel free to share it.
Okay. Well, we're at College Football News. Our website is cfn.scout.com, and people can follow me on Twitter at Matt Zemek, Z-E-M as in Michael, E-K, _CFN. And the new item that we're going to trot out next week at CFN is something called Moving Parts. And what that means is, as the season, you know, acquires more mileage and as results begin to come into focus, I'm going to spend the final 7 weeks of the season just monitoring, you know, which records mean more, which records mean less. In other words, does a 6-2 record in early November represent strength or does it represent weakness? You know, was it attained against a strong schedule or a weak schedule? And I'm going to compare and match various teams and conferences across the country so that when we get to late November, we'll have a much clearer idea of how each team's resume stacks up in the final bowl championship series race.
Well, I know that sounds very interesting to me. I can't wait to see what you have to say about it. That's something that I'm definitely going to be looking forward to. I look forward to just about everything you guys post over there at College Football News. It's a great site, a lot of great analytical and commentary. It's a lot of great stuff, so I highly encourage everybody to go check it out. I'll be sure to link it up on the page and everything on Crystal Ball Run. And, Matt, hopefully we can do this again sometime.
I'd love to. Thanks, Kevin. This was a blast.